Iowa. Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We get together here every week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. Thank you for joining us today. This is community radio, and we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yeah. The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
The Donalana Kitchen is a good place to consider how we feed ourselves. Yes, we do. Some of us just go out to eat all the time, and some of us really like to spend time in the kitchen. But either way, we kind of have to keep in mind what we put into our bodies. It is important. It is important. Today, we are going to visit a place, find out about a place called the Bread Lab. Wheat. Bread, it's the stuff of life. We've been, our human community's been eating wheat for a long time. And we met a man called Steve Jones. He was in Ames last week for an ISU lecture. There's a series called the Shivers Lectures. It gathers interesting people to talk about food and food systems. And that was last week, and we got to meet him.
Yes, we actually had lunch at my house because I had heard such wonderful things about this man. I initially encountered him through reading Dan Barber's book, The Third Plate, which is Dan Barber is a world-renowned chef from Blue Hill Farms at Stone Barns. So he's a big food systems champion from a culinary chefing perspective. And his book was really about how, as eaters and cooks, we need to really be aware of what it takes for the farmers to produce this plate of food. And so one of the things that he talked about was in grains, there's something called crop rotation. So, and Steve Jones gets into this. Steve Jones is from the Skagit Valley, which is Washington State, along the coast, kind of between, say, Seattle and Vancouver.
So, way up there in the northwest corner. Yes,
right, where it's very humid, a lovely growing season in many ways. And Steve talks about this in the tape, which we will play for you soon. But what goes on in his region is, he says, fairly small farms, but what they're growing are high-value crops, a lot of flower bulbs, for example.
Flower as in
F-L-O-W-E-R foods, bulbs, and things like that. But in order to keep the soil, fully nourished, they have to rotate these crops because you can't just like we try not to do in Iowa to grow corn on corn on corn on corn. You know, sometimes you do grow a bean, which is the soybean part of the rotation, which puts the nitrogen back in the soil. And then, of course, in organic farming systems, which Steve works extensively with, you must have a 3-year crop rotation. So you cannot grow, for example, in Iowa, corn and beans and corn and beans. You have to have a small grains rotation because that does several things. It puts nutrients back into the soil, and it also breaks some weed and pest cycles because different things will eat the corn, then will eat the small grains, da 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 da. So Steve's job in the Pacific Northwest as a wheat breeder was to improve the value of that rotation, the small grains rotation, for the local farmers. And obviously, like the corn crop here grows good. We get good return. Well, we used to. When corn prices are good, you get a fairly decent return on your investment as a farmer in the years where you plant the corn. And organic farmers, even in Iowa, have a problem with their small grains rotations in that the market for that grain is not as strong. You know, you drive around Iowa and you see these tall grain silos, but they're all for corn and soybeans. You know, there's nothing for oats or barley or whatever the farmer's choosing for that crop rotation. So same thing in the Pacific Northwest where their rotation is with wheats. Steve began breeding very specialized wheats that were good for the farmer, grew well, had interesting flavors, and the idea, there are several things that Steve is advancing in terms of food systems that I thought were absolutely brilliant. And one of them, in Iowa, we talk about value added. You know, okay, is this a value added crop? Is this and organic is considered often a value added proposition because you actually can command a higher price for your product. However, Steve is saying, no, not, the value is already there.
We're dealing with good food here.
Right. That's
valuable.
The farmer has grown it. It is valuable. What he's talking about is value retained. Okay, how do you keep that added on price within your community? And what they have done in his community is they have built mills to mill the flour. They have built bakeries to bake the bread from it. They have built malting facilities, so there's more breweries going in. So as he was saying, in his relatively small part of the world, what they've done is create, for example, 200 extra new jobs in the millers, in the bakeries, in the malters, in the breweries, right there in his neighborhood. Now, we would call that value added. He's calling it value retained. It means the money from those industries and the jobs actually stays right in his community. Now, with the amount of brain drain that we're sort of experiencing and loss of small town life, this is a valuable, insightful piece of information for Iowa and other rural communities. The other thing that he talks about is that his model in his community for retaining this value, he said, people say to me, but is it scalable? Because we all think of global food systems, industrial food systems.
Everybody do the same thing.
That's right. How can we do this on a bigger scale? Well, he goes, no, it's not scalable. But the model is replicable. That means our community could do the same thing. So in our tape, we do have another farmer, Earl Hafner, who has we do have a miller in our community because Earl was an organic farmer. He was growing, you know, the third crop that you have to have within organic systems and going, oh, well, how can I make money on this? Well, Earl jumps into everything, and pretty soon he's building a flour grinding operation and packaging it and marketing it and da-da-da-da-da. So, of course, knowing that Steve Jones was advocating and had lots of experience with this at our luncheon table, we had to have Earl so that Earl could hear what Steve had to say and vice versa. So we have a little bit of what Steve Jones is doing is we have replicated it here in Iowa.
Yes, let's find out more about Steve Jones and this wonderful thing that he's created called the Bread Lab, a fine experiment.
I just want to say one more thing about this model that Steve Jones is advocating for. It is the model where communities all over the globe are still. This is the ancient model. Every community produces what it needs and has different members doing different functions, whereas this industrial global agriculture model is relatively new to the human species. And I must say, it's a bit of an experiment, and sometimes it goes awry. So knowing that Steve's model is replicable and that we can still go back to that is very comforting. That's what the human species is used to. Community, community, community.
Good. Let's listen to what Steve Jones has to say.
Okay, so we're here at the kitchen table, Lana and I, with Steve Jones, the very interesting wheat breeder. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here. Well, you just said something that Lana and I harp on all the time, because, of course, we're talking about why people should cook their own food and why it's not really a time savings or a money savings to buy prepared foods. And you said a statement. What's that phrase you used?
Well, one thing that we're really interested in is putting time back as an ingredient into our foods. And there's no better example than bread, actually. So you can make it quickly, and the actual time that you're not doing other things isn't that great. But time as an ingredient in any of our foods brings flavor and nutritional value, certainly. And use fermentation, and fermentation takes time. And during fermentation, you're breaking down components. The gluten breaks down during fermentation. It becomes less strong. The phytates are broken down, which means iron and zinc are more available to us, bringing flavors and things like that. Fermentation brings on the gases from the yeasts and bacteria doing the things that they do, whether it's a beer or bread, a pretty similar process.
And tell us about your work at Washington State University.
So we're the bread lab. We're at Washington State University, north of Seattle. So our main campus is 6 hours to the east, near Idaho. We have a small research station between Seattle and Vancouver, Canada, in the Mount Vernon area. Skagit Valley is where we're located. There's about 80,000 contiguous acres there, and we grow 80 different crops of commercial value. Two of those crops are barley and wheat.
Of course, it makes sense when you explain this, but tell us how unique the bread lab is in terms of you're a wheat breeder. Why do you have all these bakers around?
So we work directly with our community, whether it's the mayor of Mount Vernon or our congresswoman, Susan DelBene, the growers, the eaters, the chefs, the bakers, the millers, maltsters, distillers, students, scientists. We all come together to inform each other back and forth and to how we want our food to look, but how we want our communities to work, you know, together towards that goal of farming and food, how we eat, how we choose what to eat, and what's available to us. What's available to us, not just in terms of the ingredients, but also the knowledge, how we can bring food back into our kitchens and bake and cook again. I grew my first wheat crop at Chico State in 1977, so they had a program for undergrads that you could learn how to farm. So I grew up in Cupertino in the Bay Area. It was a suburb of San Francisco. I didn't know anything about farming. I did know about baking. My Polish grandmother taught me to bake when I was 6 years old. She and her husband were basically peasants from Poland that came to this country about 100 years ago. So we'd always baked in our family. We always talked about bread and sort of the notion of bread. I then just fell in love with wheat as a crop, and I worked with it ever since. I did my undergrad, a master's, and a PhD, all working with wheat and bread. So in the bread lab, we're west of the Cascade Range in the state of Washington, and it's a different type of agriculture. It's outside the commodity system. 44% of the farmers in our state are west of the Cascades, but they're sort of hidden out in the community. The average farm size is 100 acres. The average farm size in the U.S. is over 1,000. The average wheat farm is many times that. But within that community of this average 100-acre size and growing 80 different crops, we have a farm gate value of over $250 million. So agriculture's real there. It's just diverse and small to mid-range. Wheat fits into those rotations very well because it's important to add organic matter, it's important to add diversity back into our systems, and it's important to keep value where it's produced within a system. And there's no better example than wheat for that, where we grow wheat in our region, we grow barley in our region, it's now milled and malted in the region, it's baked and brewed and distilled in the region as well. And each time that occurs, you're adding value to it. So it's beyond sort of the silliness of local, right, in terms of just doing local for the hell of it or the trendiness of it, but it's practice there for the economics of it and the power of adding knowledge back into your own food system. deciding what you want to eat and how. And then within that, embedded within that then is the notion of access as well, bringing affordability and good food to more members of our community. So not pricing people out based on just because it's local or regional, it has to cost more. So we don't believe in that either.
So do you think a net result of this in your area, through retaining the value added within your communities, has this, like, for example, in Iowa, we're having the drain the countryside. We're losing population. We're consolidating school systems. We're having a brain drain. Is that then, are you able to preserve your rural livelihoods through these?
So there's two things there at least. And one is we don't add value. You don't have to. You just capture it. So you don't let it go away. It's a really important point is we don't have to add value. There's plenty of value there. There always is. Who gets that value? And do we let it disappear from our region? So the first thing we do is capture it. We put our arms around the value and keep it where we are. The next is, yes, it does allow us to keep our communities more vibrant. So adding a flour mill, how many working wage jobs is that? A malt house, a brewery. So the head of the Port of Skagit, Patsy Martin, which is where our facility is, it's at the Port of Skagit, she said that because of the work from our lab, we've added 200 living wage jobs to the community within the past 2 years. 200 living wage jobs. That's real, and that helps people stay within the community.
Plus, it's interesting jobs, too.
They're fun. I mean, you're working in a brewery or a flour mill or a malt house or a bread laboratory or bakeries and things like that. Yeah, people, they find a satisfaction from it. We also hear from the growers, and this is going all the way down in the southern Willamette in Oregon, is many of the growers feel a certain satisfaction that was lacking, in their words, because now they see where they're producing food, yes, and that food is somewhere that they can point to. They can go to a bakery and buy bread that was made from their wheat. They can eat animals that were raised, animal or milk or eggs or whatever, raised from things that they helped produce. So that's, can't underestimate that value. We hear that one very often from growers that for the first time we're seeing where our food goes, and they're growing food, and it's that may sound obvious or trivial. It's not.
There's wheat that actually has flavor. You're dealing with bakers.
White flour is white flour. If you don't make it so white, there are tremendous flavors there. So the first wheat that we baked in our region, and again, this is north of Seattle. This isn't the wheat belt. This is a farming community that grows wheat. So I think another important notion, these are farmers that grow wheat. These aren't wheat farmers. And it's a really important point that there are wheat farmers in our state, that's what they grow. These are farmers that grow very diverse crops. So the 2009, the first year we were there, we grew some hard red winter. We milled it locally in a small mill. We took it to Seattle and had it baked by a professional baker at Essential Baking. He said that bread had chocolatey overtones with a hint of spice. And he said it was the best. He said it was the best bread that he's had in 33 years of professional baking. So there's a terroir to our wheats. We know that. And there is flavor. The flavor comes through time, as we mentioned. So how we develop flavors through time, it also comes from growing wheat out of place, which where we are is cold and wet, and then including as much or all of the bran and germ on there as possible. And there's this folklore that you can't make bread that's 100% whole wheat that you would want to eat. That's not true. So just if you're a home baker, just add more water to what you do. That'll help.
Very good. Well, so you're written about in Dan Barber's book, The Third Plate, which is where I kind of discovered, and I'm sure other people did also. You probably became instantly famous. But the point in the book is he talks about you are a wheat breeder, but you built a lab full of baker's equipment, which is not normal for a wheat breeder. And tell us about that adventure.
It was great, and we started from scratch where we ended up. So we were on the main campus. Again, it's 6 hours to the east of where we are now. We came into a community, and we didn't know, and we're still with the university, we didn't know that we would even work with wheat or bread, and the growers wanted us to add value to that part of the rotation where there's very little. And then we decided, we figured out pretty early, there's no one to really test what we do because we're non-commodity. We have purple wheats, we have black barley, we have all these interesting things. How do we test it? So we decided to just do it ourselves. So I could bake. I hired a baker, and we made a little bakery, and then we brought people in, or they just came from around the country and around the world, and they started baking and milling and doing everything that we're doing. It was incredibly fun. It's important for my graduate students. These are PhD students that not only can they breed wheat, but they can talk to chefs and bakers. They can talk and be part of a community. It's very important that when they graduate from my program, from our program, that they can be part of a community, understand what it takes to make bread or a scone or a cookie, to understand what it means to farm that, to mill it, to malt it, to brew it, to distill it, and to cook it. It's really satisfying to see that. When I was trained as a PhD student in genetics, I counted chromosomes for 5 years. I counted 600,000 chromosomes from scratch. Okay, that's great. I'm pretty damn good at that, right? So I didn't look up from the microscope much, and I wish I had.
So you're really breeding for flavor, and not, it's back to the quality and not necessarily quantity.
No. So yes, the quality, but also the quantity. So our model is that we make it work for the farmer first. It has to. We don't do heirloom or heritage anything. Mm-hmm. Just on yield alone. So we don't believe in pricing people out. Mm-hmm. We don't believe in pricing people within our communities out of the availability of good food. That means yield. And mm-hmm. to breeders, that means making more. And we can do that. That's what breeders do. We do that first. So we get wheats that yield very well. We have wheats in our area, conventional and organic farmers can easily be over 150 bushels per acre, which is phenomenal. So that can bring the price point down, and then we bring it into the lab and figure out the best use for that, as opposed to a model where it's going to work for industry, and now we're going to make it work for the farmer. This works for the farmer first, and then we bring it in and we bake with it, or we cook it, or malt it, or distill it, or brew it, and we see, is it going to be a tortilla or a flatbread or a really nice rustic loaf or a cake or whatever, scone? What is the best use for it? There are best uses for our grain. It's our job to discover those after we make it work for the farmer. So it is both quantity and quality. And the quality is defined by nutritional value and flavor, and then the functionality, the mechanical functionality. Will it make a tortilla? Okay, that's great. Or a tortilla wheat is not going to make a very rustic baguette, probably. So we develop all different types and then find the best use. That's how the lab works.
So then are you losing some of those distinctions about a hard wheat and a soft wheat, or are you inventing your own names for what works how?
For sure. Those are artificial things put on, and they've been there for over 100 years.
Yeah.
And so soft wheat or hard wheat or red wheat or white wheat is done so that an individual can go into a rail car, dip in with their hand, and say, or a barge or ocean-going ship, and say, that's hard and red, that's going to be bread wheat. That's the commodity system, and it has to be that way. Or it's soft and white, it's going to be a pastry. Or it's soft and red, it's going to be a cracker or whatever it is. Or it looks like a durum, it's going to act like a durum. That doesn't have to be the case where we are, because we're out of that system. We can define those uses. Exactly right. We can have a soft red that makes a very good loaf of bread. We can have a soft white that makes a good loaf of bread, or one that makes a horrible loaf of bread. Or it all depends. So we lose that market distinction immediately. And once you do that, it frees you up again to find the best uses for it. So it's a bit novel, that notion of getting out of the commodity system. Once you're out of the commodity system, you have the responsibility but also the luxury to redefine what you have. And we do a lot of redefinition in the lab.
How many mills do you have?
So in our lab, we have 13 mills ourselves. In the region, we have Fairhaven Organic Flour Mill, which is 10 minutes away. We have Cairn Springs Mill, which is a 3-minute walk from our lab. And then you have Camas Country Mill, which is down in Eugene, Oregon. So in that region, in our food region, or the I-5 corridor, however you want to define it, you have three commercial mills of some scale. And those sell retail and wholesale. They use grains from the region. Fairhaven Organic Flour Mill is a good example. 8 years ago, they used zero wheat from the state of Washington. Today, they use 100%. So Cairn Springs and Camas use almost exclusively Oregon and Washington wheats. They have stone mills, they have roller mills, they have impact mills. These are real mills.
Does that mean a farmer can, like, have his identity preserved wheat run all the way through the milling process?
Yes, if it's up on scale. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there are smaller mills, too. So Nash Huber out on the Olympic Peninsula has some 20 or 30-inch stone mills there. So toll milling or milling small batches is difficult for most millers. They don't want people to bring in wheat that has rocks in it or something, let's say. So it doesn't work well for the mill. So yes and no. So normally the millers that we work with, they would work with farmers ahead of time as opposed to some people coming up in a clapped out half-ton truck with some crappy wheat in the back, you know, that want it milled. So that doesn't work for most millers. They need to buy their own mill and handle that themselves, the growers, which does happen. But it's usually at some scale. It's usually a ton or 1,000 pounds or maybe much more than that. But it can happen, but it usually is planned out ahead of time. But certainly single varietals are there from single farms. All these millers can trace to the exact farm where it came from. It's not bulked up ahead of time, maybe bulked up afterwards. So they may have three varieties that they would blend into something for some type of function, a strong bread wheat or a mellow wheat or a bread or something like that.
So then are the farmers, is it sort of like with animal processing? For example, you can take all of your cattle, this is on a smaller local scale, in to have it processed. You get the meat back, then the farmer sells it. Or is it more like the miller buys the wheat, makes their blends, and then the miller sells it?
That would be the case. So what you're describing with the, you know, selling half a cow or quarter cow or however that goes, that would occur more off farm, and that does occur. So there are some small operations where they have a mill. You have some growers that sell out of farm stands or CSAs or however they would do it. Mm-hmm. But once you get up to a scale, it's pretty much turned over to the miller. They buy it from the farmer. Farmers may be partners. Mm-hmm. So the mm-hmm. mills that I mentioned, two of them, they're farmer partners in there as well. You also have groups like King Arthur Flour is investing in regional mills, as is Patagonia, so the clothing manufacturer. King Arthur is part owner in one of the small mills.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. So okay. So you have people of some scale themselves coming into the food system in meaningful ways, helping support infrastructure. Infrastructure's gone for things like mm-hmm. this. It's gone mm-hmm. across the country for things like mm-hmm. this. Bringing it back is not simple. Not just from the knowledge base of what it takes to clean and store and properly handle grain. A lot of that's gone at some medium scale. But then just the equipment is quite specialized, and much of it's gone.
You're listening to KHOI 89.1 FM. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was musician David Cantini with his magic flute playing a tune called The Baker. I just had to slide that tune in there. The Baker. Yes, it was. We are talking to Steve Jones, a wheat breeder and the creator of the Bread Lab in Washington State. We talked with him last week, found out about his wonderful projects out there, and found out that, yes, there is a mill here in Iowa. We know that. We talked to Earl Hafner. He has early morning harvest, and he joined the discussion with Steve and Donna and I.
We happen to have at our table today Iowa's only example of a grower, farmer, organic wheat grower with his own mill, and we have Earl Hafner. So we were having a wonderful conversation, which I was just eavesdropping on. Earl, tell us a little bit about what you're doing here in Iowa. This is Early Morning Harvest, Earl Hafner from Panora.
So what we have found is by growing our own wheat, we control the quality of it. We have found that the wheat that we are now growing, we get more white flour because of our learning the efficiency, how to handle it. We're still building infrastructure to maintain quality of the grain year-long so that we have a quality product year-long. One thing interesting that we tried to do that I see Steve is doing, we have tried to get schools, churches to teach how to bake bread. And we have been not been very successful at that. Nobody has the time factor that Steve talked about. They want prepackaged bread. They want a slice of bread, make a sandwich, and go.
Or put it in the bread machine, right?
So what we would love to do is try and figure out how to teach people to bake bread. And to if you want to grow wheat as a product to maintain local use, you have to learn to grow it a quality product, low in aflatoxin, and all the toxins that come with it. That's what we have learned to do, and now it's just a matter of economics, of teaching the communities, you know, that we mill a whole grain flour. We don't take the germ out. We don't take the bran out. So we don't have to add vitamin D and call it fortified. So it is a different product, different storage. And like Steve said, it takes time.
Yes, this concept of time. It's wonderful to meet people that care about how our food tastes. Steve, you said you like to bake bread. Do you get to bake bread to your heart's content now, or are you too busy?
I do bake, so I bake in the lab often, or otherwise I bake at home, usually on Sundays. And I have for breakfast every day, I have one piece of toast with a lot of salt and peanut butter and jam on it that I made. So I do bake a lot. And to Earl's point, in terms of teaching, Skagit Community Foundation, which is one of our local groups, a small local group, they bought us a portable oven that we can bring to food banks, to women's transition housing, to the public library. We did a bake the week after Thanksgiving last year where we went into the public library with our portable oven, and 42 people came at 7:30 at night on a rainy Tuesday, and we baked bread in among the bookshelves in the library. So there's a tremendous interest in baking again. And Earl also mentioned the economics. You can easily do one of the best loaves of bread on the planet for less than a buck, right? So the ingredients are less than a dollar. You can't buy the worst bread in the world for a buck. So there's a health kick to it. There's also the economic one, and we just can't. We're biologists, and we talk more about economics than we do about biology recently. We're really interested in the affordability and the knowledge gap of what it takes to make a loaf of bread. And to cook in general. But I can do a loaf of sourdough bread in 20 minutes of work.
Spaced out over how much time?
Yeah, so it may take a day to do it from mixing to final bake, but the actual time that I'm not doing something else, which is what's important, which is the definition of the time, is about 20 minutes and less than a dollar. And there's a gratification and some satisfaction to it. It's wonderful. So I think, and we work with a lot of people that are getting back into baking that hadn't baked in many years, in some cases for 20 or 30 years, and coming back into it and just finding sort of the peace and beauty that can be found in something like bread, even when it doesn't work, and it's still fun.
Do you exclusively use sourdoughs?
So we do. So in our lab, we use almost exclusively 100% whole wheat, as Earl was saying. We use sourdough. The ingredients in our wheats, in our breads, are flour, water, salt, and starter, and that starter is the microbe. So it has either three or four ingredients, depending on how you define it. But we don't use commercial yeast. And sourdough people shouldn't shy away from it. Once you get into it, it's quite simple. It's much more forgiving than yeast. It really is. The time is much more flexible.
And it tastes better.
It tastes incredible. It stores well because the pH is lowered down, so it won't mold as quickly as other breads. It tastes less sweet. It has a brightness to it. So I really like the flavor of a sourdough style bread. It doesn't have to be super acidic.
Yeah.
It just doesn't. You can manage that too. I'd encourage people to become greater members in their food community and really think about the accessibility of what we do and sort of sharing the knowledge of how quite frankly how simple it can be to cook very good food and then how economical that is and how that can bring folks together as well. So that would be it.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Bread. We had a wonderful time talking about bread. I learned a whole lot.
Yeah, give us this day our daily bread.
Thing to do around a kitchen
table.
Absolutely. Yes, yes. Steve Jones, you said you found out about Steve Jones through the Third Plate book by Dan Farber. Mm-hmm. And I just, the week that Steve Jones was here, I often mention books on this program. I happened to be reading a book, and I probably classify it sort of as a speculative fiction kind of book, but it was kind of this romp through a life of a baker. And the book was called Sourdough by a author named Robin Sloan. And it's just kind of, it's kind of like the sourdough starter that takes over the West Coast, you know, kind of one of these amazing sort of things. But I mentioned the book to Steve Jones. He said, oh, yes, I know that book. That's great. Robin Sloan's coming to visit my bread lab next week. So, yeah, a lot of people find their way there because it's a wonderful thing that's happening at the bread lab. If you want to find out more, I believe you can Google bread lab. There's lots of things going on out there.
Yes, bread is a very attractive thing. For example, if you're baking and the smells are wafting out of your kitchen,
waft, waft,
your neighbors may come knocking on your door.
See?
It's a very powerful draw.
Builds community, I
That's
hear
right,
say.
It does.
Yes, it
does.
And Steve's way of connecting art, philosophy, bakers, and the science of how to create all this different kind of wheat and different kind of vegetables. So after all, he's kind of doing your university extension work out there, kind of among that the farmers in that valley, doing great things for his community. You're listening to KHOI. This is 89.1 FM. This is Community Radio. And this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. Thank you. Welcome back. We're talking bread today. We had a visit to the bread lab in Washington State, and we're back here in the kitchen. Donna, you've got something to say about manipulating things. Scientists manipulate
things. This is a news item that happened this week, and it's about, it's called CRISPR.
Oh, do tell me what CRISPR. A CRISPR is.
It's a new genetic modification technique, right? So instead of the GMOs that we've been talking about and dealing with for the last 15 or 20 years, very controversially, at least some people are not. We don't consider that it's a settled science. Some people think it's a done deal and it's a really great thing. Other people think that, well, we're still in experimental stage. So there is a new technology that's the GMOs that we've been discussing for the last however long had to do with transgenic modification, which is taking a gene from, say, a fish and putting it into a tomato, which is a transgenic modification. Now, genetic modification is plant breeding, animal breeding. We've been doing this for thousands of years. It's just natural selection. But transgenic modification is something that in nature could never happen. The fish does not breed with the tomato. We all know that, you know.
It sounds pretty kinky.
It's pretty straightforward. So that has been where genetic modification has been working. Now, there is a new technology, and this is what CRISPR is. It is called gene editing. So within an already existing and viable life form, they have developed a way to go into the DNA and turn on and off certain genetic markers. Now, the promise of this technology is, for example, medically speaking, you could say you are from a family that has sickle cell anemia, which is a genetic disorder and a very serious one. So perhaps the hope is that whatever the genetic abnormality is that's causing this problem can be regulated so that the next generation doesn't have to deal with the health conflicts. And there are many, many diseases that are like this, genetically defined, and it is a wonderful possibility. However, there are many applications to this. For example, they've created, I believe, an apple that no longer turns brown. Okay, that's a convenience factor. That is not a life and death
thing. And they've done that by CRISPRing it.
I think so. Well, okay. I'm just studying this more and more in depth. So here's what happened with CRISPR this week. Because, of course, this is all government regulated, as well it should be. Perhaps it should be more, perhaps it should be less. But the USDA has announced, and they've been toying with this, but they made it very clear that they will not regulate CRISPR genetic changes. The thinking from the USDA is that, well, we're not crossing species, it's not creating novel blah blahs, life forms or whatever, and it's all safe and it's good and it's wonderful. Well, the effect of this is that a lot of money and time and regulatory hurdles will be saved by the people that are exploring this, which also it means that the romp to market will ramp up.
Okay.
Now, my problem with this is there's still a lot of questions about the technology itself. You know, it's fair. It's not a done deal. There's a rush to commercialize it. A lot of people are going to make a lot of money. That's just what the USDA has said. However, the FDA wants to very tightly regulate the technology in its animal forms. So, for example, the USDA means you can go ahead and breed all the fruits and vegetables and grains that you want to with CRISPR technology, and we're going to say go for it. It's going to end up in your food. It's going to be – you won't know you're eating it, basically. They're saying no limitations, folks. Now, the FDA, which is regulating the animal side of it, has maintained that they want to – they are considering CRISPR technologies as a drug.
Oh.
So they're going to be much more strict because what they're talking about, they're making this distinction. So in the medical side of it, they're not going to run in and start manipulating those genes in either the animals or the humans, right? Mm-hmm. In the animal side, it's not going to be okay to do that. Whereas in the plant side, it's going to be okay to do that. But, of course, there is this little tricky gray area. The animals, including the humans, are going to be eating those plants. Hello. So there will be that overlap, and we poor innocent eaters are not going to perhaps know what we're eating. I am going to do a bit more research, and because this was true with the transgenic genetic modification, which we also do not have labeling on. It's been a major, major battle for consumers. However, the USDA organic label did not allow transgenic genetic modification with the USDA organic label. So I'm pretty sure the same thing will happen with CRISPR, but I'm not sure. So I'm going to make an inquiry into that, and we will be having more information about that. Because I'm not ready still to be the guinea pig on all of this in my human biome.
What, but just the words makes a lot of money for somebody, ought to kind of put up some flags there.
Yeah, because it's not making money for me. I'm not willing to risk being, nor the people that I feed and care about. Now, given that I'm a very small drop in the ocean, but somehow, as my American God-given right, I want to be able to make that decision myself.
Yeah, yeah. So let's keep our ears open for this CRISPR technology.
So just know that as of now, the USDA has said, we are not going to regulate that. It will not be labeled. And this is a bigger conversation. Just wanted you folks to know that there has been that announcement by the USDA this week.
Ha.
Dum-da-dum.
On to a little less controversial subject. Talk about avocados.
Oh, yes. We have had a bumper avocado crop this year. As you've noticed in the stores, you can get them for, talk about cheap food. Some places I've seen them as much as, instead of $3 an avocado, it's 3 avocados for $1. So we've been eating a lot of avocados. This is because avocados are an alternate bearing a crop. That means every other year the tree will produce a light crop. And in the years in the between, which is this year, it's a heavy crop. So there's a lot of avocados around. So we can certainly take advantage of that this year. I do love an avocado. It's also a very nutritionally dense powerhouse that has almost 20 nutrients, including potassium, vitamin K, folate, vitamin Bs and C, as well as being a good source of healthy fats. So what have you been doing with avocados?
Well, avocados, all I think of is just eat them on a salad.
Guacamole.
And always make sure to put a little lemon juice or
avocado toast. So,
yeah. Oh, tell us about avocado toast.
Well, it's sort of become the scuttlebutt of jokes about millennials that they're eating avocado toast. But it's
it really is
a good idea. It's not just for millennials. You know, you can flavor your avocado many, many, many ways. The classic guacamole would be as limited as a little salt, pepper, and lemon juice. Mm-hmm. However, you can also throw in all kinds of other things. My basic one includes chopped raw onions. I've been making one with a miso mayonnaise base. Of course, you can put in all kinds of herbs that you want and just spread that on a piece of toast and put a little bacon on top or something like that. I mean, you know, the possibilities are endless. And, of course, it's the ideal fast food. You just take it, squirt the lemon juice in, mash it up and whatever you want. And there was a good recipe for a vegan mayonnaise made with avocado. It says with their silky texture and fat content, it mimics the mouthfeel of mayonnaise made with eggs. It's easy to make. I don't even have the recipe here. Sorry, folks.
You probably just mush it up.
Yeah, and I think maybe on this one they emulsified it with a food processor or else a hand blender or something like that. There was another, I saw on the internet, look this one up, folks, a chocolate cake. A vegan chocolate cake made with avocado. I mean, avocados are wonderful as a because they do have a unique oily structure and they're kind of flavor. I mean, they're a little bit flavor neutral. They're very, very subtle. Like I remember when my son was in high school. Of course, we're running out of the house every morning. I used to make a smoothie, and I always put an avocado banana smoothie. Is it quite a delight?
Very good.
You just take a little milk and or yogurt. If you have good eggs like Lana has, you could plop an egg in it. But then the avocado and the banana together make this lovely green, and the silky texture of the smoothie, and then the banana is the sweetener. Simple as can be. Get those avocados now. We're in a like boom season.
Yeah.
Quickly.
Now, avocado, here we are in central Iowa, and we're talking about local food.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's not very local. Right?
It does not mean that we do not import and export, and we are still able to enjoy this wonderful stuff from all over.
Right, the avocados, the lemons. We don't grow lemons here either.
Good. So, that's very good. I like avocado.
Yeah, we've been on, of course. It's lovely when they're so affordable.
Right. And it must be the Brussels sprouts must grow on the same tree every other year, because this year is a Brussels sprout year, too.
Oh, we're going to have a Brussels.
No, we have the last one.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's an on again and off again, but somehow maybe those two things go together. They're both
green. Don't apples do that, too?
Yeah,
one year is a bumper crop, and then, I mean, per tree, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Give those trees a year off. Yes, yes. Well, let's see. We've talked about avocados and crispers and the bread lab today. We've got a few upcoming things. In particular, later this month, KHOI, this very own community radio station, is going to have a fun drive.
Oh, boy.
Yeah?
The fun drive is a fun drive.
It is.
Yes.
It starts April 16th, going through April 29th. Our chance to remind you that we cannot do it without you. This is a community.
Nor would we want to do it without you.
No. And so there'll be stuff coming up later this month. That'll be good. Also, but coming up next week and in the weeks to come, we'll be talking to the Practical Farmers of Iowa folks, because they know what's going to go on in the field here. There's a lot of field days, a lot of farmer-related
things. Yes, and hopefully spring is coming up.
Well, and they'll know what to do with it. You know? So we'll find out more about what's going on in the field this weekend. Ames Music Walk, that is Friday, April 6th, 5 to 8, downtown music.
Local music!
Yeah.
Yeah,
let's hope that I hope they have, like, hot toddies, because it's kind of chilly. But it's good. That's good. We can do that.
Yes, we can.
So we'll look for all those good things coming up. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We've had music today by David Cantini from his CD Red Rock, and we'll go out with a couple of jigs, starting out with one called Scatter the Mud. Scatter the Mud. It's a good spring tune.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us today. You can join us every Tuesday at noon and 7 p.m. repeated Tuesday evening on this fine community radio station. Go to khoifm.org to find out more, to download things. Support this station. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering today. Bye. Colby Gaines, thank you for joining us. Yes, we did. Eat good food and enjoy life.
Oh, yes.